very fascinated about it. It's an excellent program and an organization. I was really touched by what they do. So quite exciting about that, and there's all kinds of new books coming out. So I'm looking forward to 2013.
Well, we are too. And Bob, what did you want to say?
Oh, I got something to say. Folks, you don't know, or some of you may know, but most of you probably know who we're talking with, an award-winning author. That's right, Mr. Zimmerman. Why don't you just give us 1 minute, tell us about your book and where it is right now on the bestseller list.
Oh, you're making me blush.
Oh, I hope I did.
You can see it. He's burning up the phone lines here.
Yeah, well, that you're talking about Lincoln's Last Days, which I co-wrote with Bill O'Reilly. That has been just...
Who?
Yeah.
The, folks, that's the Bill O'Reilly. I mean, I'm pumping my chest enough, but I mean, this man is so modest, Mr. Zimmerman, that, well, please continue.
Okay. But it's been doing very well, thank you. It's on the New York Times bestseller list still. It's been about 15, close to 20 weeks now on there. It's been number one for a while. That's my latest book. The other one I'm really proud of is Uncommon Valor, the Medal of Honor and the Warriors from Afghanistan and Iraq who received it. That book has gotten some great praise, and it's won awards, too. So, and then there are a few other books out there that that I've done. The program, even though I'm hosting it, it's not about me. We want to get to our guests.
Yeah, well, but one more thing. Hey, Dale, did you hear all that? So he can pay his bill now, okay? Yeah, let's send him his bill. All kidding aside, Dwight, it was great working with you this year. Look forward to 2013.
Yeah, same here, Bob.
Well, we're going to I'm going to give Dwight just a second to introduce his program, and then we'll take our first break. But I want to remind people, we want to talk a little bit with you about the last year and some of your comments about what's been going on Veterans Radio. And we're going to look back at a little bit at the lives of Betty Flanders and Betty and the Boys and during the last segment of the program. So we want you to stick around for that. But Dwight, go ahead and introduce your what we're going to be talking about today, and then we'll take a break.
Okay. Well, I'm really happy about this program, the final one of 2012. We got a great lineup. A little departure here, but Stephen Roman did a wonderful fantasy called Blood Feud. It's absolute, excellent writing, and we'll get into that in a little bit. Basically, if you've got a teenage daughter or granddaughter or know someone who does, this is a book that worth paying attention to. And the other book is Stand To, A Journey to Manhood by E. Franklin Evans. This is his memoir of his experiences in Vietnam, where he went from a raw teenager to a combat veteran. And it's a very moving story, and I was deeply touched by many of the passages in there, and I'm just so happy that he... is going to be on our show. The book has won a couple of really good awards, the gold medal from the Military Writers Society, and the and author of the year in Georgia Writers Organization. So we'll take our break, and we'll have our first guest, Steve Roman.
Okay, we will do that. And if you want to get in on a conversation, you can give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. And we'll be right back after this message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2000. 2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we are back here on Veterans Radio with Dwight Zimmerman and his guest. And Dwight, you're ready to go.
Thank you, Dale. Okay, our first guest this morning is author Stephen A. Roman, who has written an absolutely thrilling and exciting book called Blood Feud. It's the first book in the saga of Pandora Zwieback. Steve, welcome aboard.
Hey, that's me. Morning, guys.
Yep.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thank you for being here. So, you wrote a really decent book here.
Thank you.
You know, tell our listeners a little bit about the story.
Well, it's, I would think, outside the norm for most of your listeners, but it's the story of a 16-year-old girl who lives in New York. She's part of the goth culture, so that she wears a lot of black, a lot of makeup, but that's only her outward appearance. She's actually a very likable, very lovable girl who is loyal to her parents. She loves her parents a lot, even though they're divorced, and loyal to her friends and very adventurous and outspoken. She has a dark part to her history because for the past 10 years, she has been seeing monsters which had been diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenia, but considering that this is an urban fantasy novel, it turns out that actually her ability to see monsters is a hidden gift that she never knew that she had. And in the story of Blood Feud, she meets an immortal monster hunter named Sebastian, who guides her through the knowledge of what her gift actually is, and sort of sets her on the path to where her story will be going.
Yeah, the thing that I found fascinating here was how you tapped into teenage angst and alienation. It was really, quite moving, in that. Could you elaborate on that, please?
There's actually a lot of Pan that I'm not sure where it came from. I may be tapping into old background as a teenager myself, where I was sort of the oddball in school, and the ways that I dealt with it. Pan is sort of has aspects of me, but I was never as alienated as she feels in the book. And a lot of that, in her case, has to do with the fact of believing that she was suffering from a disorder. And so that separates her from the children in the high school that she attends, where she was sort of the new girl. So she was even more alienated from her situation because of the fact that she's the new girl in school and not quite fitting in. And so it's taking what's really been out there, what a lot of kids are going through today, and just using Pan as sort of a stand-in for them, and hopefully showing them a way that beyond the fantasy trappings, there is a way to get through their problems.
Yeah, so while she's dealing with literally a one-of-a-kind identity crisis, you know, she finds herself caught in the middle of a war between rival vampire clans from Japan, London, and Eastern Europe.
Exactly, and those are just the three that I show in that book. The idea is that there's a whole clan rivalry going on around the world, so I only showed three of the vampire houses that are involved in this story.
You do some really great combat and action scenes here, which I found quite fascinating. They're very well handled, and for someone who doesn't really have any experience with weaponry, I was also impressed with how well you depicted the use of firearms and other weapons. Can you give us some of that, the research that you went through?
Well, combat situations themselves, since I have none, really start with Hollywood movies and whatever I can pick up there, because my background is extremely visual. So when I'm telling the story, when I'm describing a combat situation, I'm thinking in terms of how it looks. And so Hollywood is usually where everything starts from that. In terms of research, I use websites. There are a few weaponry websites out there that will give specs and uses and such. My first question when I started the book was for one of the Vampire Strike teams. The question was, what is that gun that they use on Stargate SG-1? And then I started researching from that. And so I found a website that lists all types of specs for that kind of thing. Then, to go one step further, I would track down YouTube videos to see how things work. During a siege scene early in the book, I talk about high explosive rounds, now having never dealt with them before. I found YouTube videos that would demonstrate how a high explosive round would work in slow motion so that I could describe it for readers who've never seen or heard of such things. So a lot of it has to do with internet research.
Okay. You have a website, don't you?
I have two, but the easiest two for people to remember is the one directly for the Pandora's Y-Back site. Shall I spell it?
Yeah, please.
Okay, it's www.pandorazweback.com.
Okay, and where can people go to get a copy of your book?
Well, mostly the book is sold through online retailers like Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. It's also available as an ebook for Kindle and Nook and various other platforms, the Apple iBook Store as one example. So it's out there. In fact, at the Pandora's Y-Back website, we have a page of links that will take you exactly to where you need to go to buy the book. So I tried to make it as easy as possible for people to track it down.
Oh, good, good. You know, one of the now for our listeners, I had the honor and pleasure of editing some of Steve's earlier books. He did an absolutely thrilling X-Men trilogy a few years ago that just absolutely spot on. So this, you know, is a great pleasure to see, you know, Steve's latest work here. Now, with Blood Feud, what was the most difficult scene that you found yourself writing?
It's usually not one scene in particular. It's whenever I have to step out to another character, because mostly the book is focused through Pan's viewpoint. When I have to step out of that to deal with other characters, then the process slows down a bit because I have to make sure that I'm not writing a character who sounds exactly like Pan with their same approach to what's going on around them. The vampires, when I write them, are a little more difficult just because they're a little more formal in how I write their speech patterns and stuff, and Pan is much easier because she has a normal teenage speech pattern without the overuse of the word like in a sentence. But other than that, it really depends on the scene. There weren't any difficult scenes in the book. It was just, how do I want to approach a character's point of view?
Which one was your most satisfying then?
The most satisfying one actually is a very short father-daughter scene between Pan and her dad after she's discovered that she's not the girl that she thought she was, and that there's a whole new world in front of her now that she's discovered that she has this special vision that allows her to see the monsters that actually exist in the world. So it's her sitting on the rooftop of her dad's apartment building watching the sunrise, and her father comes up to join her, and there's just a little bonding scene there that became my favorite scene in the book. And it wasn't actually there in the first draft. It was just something that came about as I was revising the manuscript.
Was this, did you see this as being the pivotal moment in the book, or was there something else that was pivotal?
No, it really is, because that's when Pan goes from being this very troubled girl to a girl who now sees that there's an entire world before her, and she can see it with new eyes, and she's very excited about it. So I think for her, it's a major character turn, and it really sets the tone for where she goes after that.
Okay. Now, tell us about Pan's physical appearance, because she's not, you know, even though you have a comic book background yourself, it's not, she doesn't have the exaggerated physique of comic book heroines.
No, that was actually a an intentional approach. My comic book background would normally say that Pan should be 5'7" and busty and very curvy, like a superheroine. And I thought that that would be completely the wrong way to go. And in fact, there are so many girls out there who have body issues, and magazines that push that on you, that, you know, you're too overweight or you're too short or anything that can possibly be wrong with someone, it's referred to as body snarking. And so I wanted to take Pan in the opposite direction. So she's short and cute and not busty, and it was to try and make her more approachable to young girls who might be reading the book, even adult women who have read the book, like the fact that Pan does not fall under the Hollywood stereotype of what an action heroine should be. And so I'm pleased with how that turned out and the reaction that she's gotten because of it.
Okay, well, we're coming close to the break time, so real quickly, to our listeners, you know, who have a teenage daughter or granddaughter or know someone who does, what reason would you give for them to say, yeah, this is a book for, you know, those people?
I would say that if you're looking for a book that stars a girl who is smart and funny and self-reliant, who doesn't take a lot of garbage from people and is very adventurous without being the girlfriend of somebody who has to protect her, she's the one who takes the lead, then this is a book that you should definitely check out.
Okay. Well, Steve, have you gotten any comments from teenage girls on the story?
I've gotten quite a few comments from teenage girls, but actually the ones that show me that I'm going in the right direction tend to come from adult women. The new favorite anecdote that I have comes from this past October's New York Comic Con, where I described Pan and all her background to this one woman who was interested in buying the book, and then she said to me, "That sounds like a fascinating character. Is the woman who wrote that book here?" And I pointed to the book's cover where my name was, and I pointed to my badge, and she went, "Oh my God, it's you. Will you get it? You understand it." And so she bought the book right away. And that shows me that I'm doing a good job if there can be that misconception.
Yes, indeed. So again, if you tell people where they can pick up Blood Feud?
Well, if they go to the Pandora's Wyback website, we have links. There's a button that says buy the book, and that will take you to a list of retailers that you can buy the book from, like Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Okay, that's really great. Really happy for that. Now, are you working on a sequel?
I am working on the sequel. It's called Blood Rain. It picks up where Blood Feud leaves off, and it involves a much larger picture from Blood Feud. Blood Feud was more of an intimate portrayal of a girl dealing with this larger world that she's been living in and never knowing it. Now the second book is, this is the world that she lives in and how she has to deal with it, and all the complications that came about from the events in Blood Feud.
Okay. I want to get back. Tell us a little bit more about the vampires involved in in this book, Blood Feud.
The vampires I wanted to try and make interesting. They're not what has become the type of vampire today. They're the overly romantic, Twilight-inspired sort of vampires. These are more of the vampires that I was familiar with when I was growing up reading horror comics and watching horror movies. So they're bloodthirsty, but they're very genteel in some respects and upper crust. One group in particular comes from Japan, and that was the group that I had the most fun writing because all the vampires in that group wear a fashion style that's popular called elegant and gothic Lolita. So it's very much sort of black and white, Alice in Wonderland, pinafores and lace and such things, but with a goth sensibility attached to it. So it's much darker in tone. And so I'd never really seen that before used for vampires, so I thought it would be an interesting approach to it. And because anime and manga from Japan, the comics and the animated features are very popular in the United States today, so what those gothic Lolita vampires wear in the book are exactly what you would see at a convention being worn by a teenage girl who is into that that kind of material.
Okay, and then what about that group from Eastern Europe? Those guys are pretty deadly, even by vampire standards.
The Eastern Europe strike team is heavily inspired by the Underworld movies in that they all wear leather combat outfits and they move quickly. And so it's my nod to Hollywood in that by presenting a team that's sort of out of one of those films. The idea of making the vampires brutal as they are was really, I figured that's how they should be. If they're going to be a strike team, then they are the elite warriors of their clan. And so they have to move quickly and they have to make on-site decisions. And so everything has to be abrupt and get the mission done and then get out and move on to the next mission, which in their case is continuing the search for what everyone thinks is an ultimate weapon. So they attack one site early in the book and they get information on where they might be able to track it down, and then they head right for a confrontation with the next person in line for that. So I thought it was important to have the vampires not be the adorable, sparkly, lovable ones that have sort of overtaken dark fantasy fiction these days, and to go back to vampires being not very nice people.
Tell us about this ageless monster hunter.
The ageless monster hunter is named Sebastian Mazarin. She's 400 years old. She's half French and half Brazilian. And she's been fighting monsters almost for all 400 years. She is inspired by the Highlander film franchise and crossed with any number of vampire hunters over the years. The idea is that Annie is her nickname. Annie is the one who will get the job done. Pan is not really there to kill monsters. One of the things I decide on early on is that Pan is not a vampire slayer. She's not a person who enjoys killing and is not interested in killing. Annie is the one who has the background and knows that if you want to get the job done, you have to get your hands dirty. So she is there to be the mentor and also the person who will make the hard decisions when it comes to it.
I hate to interrupt you folks, but we're going to come up on a break, Dwight, so.
Okay. Well, Steve, thank you so much for being on the show. Steve Roman, the author of Blood Feud. And this is Dwight Zimmerman of At Ease for Veterans Radio Network. And take it away, Dale.
Okay. Well, actually, Dwight, tell me who's coming up next. We're going to take a quick break, and who's going to be the next guest?
Okay. Our next guest after the break is E. Franklin Evans, who wrote an absolutely excellent memoir of his experience in Vietnam called Stand To, A Journey to Manhood, and we'll be talking with Frank right after the break.
Yes, we will. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio on WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Check it out. It's the Terminator. Hey, when'd you get back, huh?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Why are you being so jumpy? Put all that stuff behind you, okay?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org because we know where you're coming from. Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
We're back on Veterans Radio with our At Ease segment of our monthly program with Dwight Zimmerman. And Dwight, you're back.
Thank you, Dale. Welcome to Veterans Radio and At Ease. Our number here is 877-573-7825. And my next guest is E. Franklin Evans, the author of Stand To, A Journey to Manhood. Frank, welcome.
Where did he go?
Well, we're...
Frank, not there?
Frank, are you with us? Okay, well...
All right,
well,
I'll give him a call right back. In the meantime, Dwight, you need to, biz, do a little fill here.
Okay, well, I'll tell you a little bit about Stand 2. Basically, Frank, it starts out, as a kid, he watched every movie John Wayne ever made, sometimes more than once. And so the Hollywood version here, war was exciting, and heroes were made as they, you know, fought and predictably won each battle. But when Evans's high school friend and real-life hero, Glenn, was killed in Vietnam, war became real and personal. In December 66, at the age of 19, he enlisted in the Army and soon found himself entrenched in a treacherous war. In his journey from adolescence to adulthood, Frank learned not only to survive, but also to muster the bravery to lead others in combat. It took Frank more than 35 years to begin to heal the physical and emotional wounds that kept him from sharing his intensely personal story. But the result is Stand To, A Journey to Manhood. And from his depiction of the picturesque aerial view of Camaran Bay to that of barbed wire, metal planking, and squat huts housing weapons, and the adventures and terror of what happened when you go out on patrol in the jungle. Stand 2 provides a vividly detailed glimpse into what it was like to become a man on the battlefields of Vietnam. And I'm happy to say that it won a gold medal from the Military Writers Society of America and was a nominee for Georgia Author of the Year from the Georgia Writers Association. It's an absolutely stunning book. Frank has a website, and let me get that information for you right here. It is www.efranklinevans.com, and it's on that site that you can find out more about the book and about Frank and his experiences, and get order information, you know, from the book. I know it's available on Amazon, and you can buy it directly from Frank.
Try again here. I'm not sure what happened. Hold
okay.
On.
We're still...
that'll do it. All right. I'll be right back. Hold on.
Okay. I think we're going to have Frank on in just a moment. Again, his website is www.efranklinevans.com.
Excuse me to interrupt you there, Dwight. Good job of filling. Wow. That was terrific. All right. We had a little power failure wherever Frank is.
Oh.
And so we've got him back on the line now, and I believe, Frank, you are there, correct?
I'm here. Thanks very much. Sorry about
great.
That.
Great. Oh, well, welcome aboard there, Frank. Yeah.
Thank you, Dwight. I appreciate it. Yeah, we had a little power outage here in Clearwater, Florida, and we're back. Thank goodness.
Yes, indeed. Okay, well, I told people a little bit about the book, but I'd like you to explain what exactly the title Stand To, A Journey to Manhood means.
Okay, sure. Actually, this was an awakening for me in many ways, and Stand To is actually short for Stand To Arms, which was a military order that may not have originated, but was certainly a military order during the First World War, when most attacks occurred at dawn. So Stand To Arms, later shortened to Stand To, meant get up, get ready, put your combat gear on, be prepared for anything that might happen. The enemy may attack any moment. And that was, to me, my call, say Stand To, get ready for the rest of your life, wake up, and be prepared. So that's my Stand To.
Okay. So why did you write this book? Because you get very, there's some very revealing, scenes in here that had to have been difficult to write. So what drove you, especially since, said, 30-some-odd years before you could, confront all of this?
Sure. It took me about 35 years to actually get to the point where I could write and talk about my experience in Vietnam. Like many veterans of that time, it was a very unpopular war, very disruptive and confrontational and terrible time in our history for the nation. But many veterans, including myself, just didn't want to talk about what had happened. And my children, through the years, were asking me, Dad, what did you do? You were in Vietnam, what did you do? And like others, I just really didn't want to talk much about it. So what I started to do was actually write down. I thought, well, it's a journal for my children. That's how it started. And I could tell them some of the things that happened, not the blood and guts kinds of things, although there's a little bit of that in the book. Can't get away from it. But most of it is just the personal journey, if you will, of a young man who is a carefree teenager concerned about perfume and gasoline and having a good time, transformation into someone who woke up because of the death of a friend in combat, a very close friend, and it turned my world upside down and shook me and said, Frank, there's more to it than this. So that journey, my journal for my children, actually evolved into a book when a couple of fellows that worked for me were published poets, and they said, Frank, you've got to publish this. People need to read this. And so I did. And I wanted to get it written as quickly as possible because my wife at the time was dying of cancer, and I wanted it published before she passed away. And that's how it came about.
Wow. That's really powerful right there. Sorry to hear about your wife. I'm glad that you were able to complete it before she passed away.
Actually, thank you very much. I did get it in hard published form, and she saw it 1 month before she died.
Hmm. Okay, tell us about what you were feeling when the airplane carrying you into Vietnam, your first sights of Vietnam. Was it what you expected, or?
Well, it wasn't exactly what I expected. I had, the night before I departed for Vietnam, I had seen the movie Green Beret with John Wayne. Later on in my tour, I saw that kind of action in person. But when I flew into Cameron Bay, I was very apprehensive. The plane, there was a mix of veterans and young guys like me who just didn't know what to expect. And as I flew in, I thought, this is a beautiful country. As we came into Cameron Bay on the coast, you could see green rice fields, beautiful mountains, ocean, beaches. The closer we got to landing, I noticed around the airstrip, my first dose of reality, if you will, were the Quad 50s, the armed Vietnamese soldiers guarding the airfield. And so it quickly changed, what a beautiful country, to, well, this is a dangerous place here.
indeed. Now, you were a second lieutenant, and this is your first time taking command of men. Tell us a little bit about that experience with your first command.
Well, it was satisfying, a little bit daunting. I was a graduate of the Benning School for Boys, Infantry Officer Candidate School. From there, I was assigned to the Ranger Department, where I was working with counter-guerrilla operations, teaching ambushing and quick fire techniques and things like that. So I was pretty well skilled, I thought, and ready for the job. So I hit the ground, and when I was finally assigned to a platoon, which was an experience in itself because I replaced a relieved platoon leader who had panicked during his first firefight. My introduction was the company commander saying, "Lieutenant Woods, pack your stuff. You're relieved. Lieutenant Evans is here to replace you." So it hit me right in the face. And all of a sudden, I was in charge of about 30 people, some of who were older, many of who were my age or younger, but it was me they looked to. Fortunately, I did have a seasoned platoon sergeant to help me along the way. But it was quite exciting and at the same time, pretty scary.
Yeah. What year was it that you did your first tour there?
Well, this was 1968.
Okay.
August 1968.
Okay. Now, life in a combat zone is not all fighting.
No.
And you're... So... And what a lot of people who are not veterans or haven't been in combat situations, it's amazing at how much everything is, just every aspect of life. It just tends to be more so, if I may use that term. Tell us
sure.
a little bit about your first patrol there, and particularly there's this experience he had with some red peppers.
Oh, yes. I remember that well. Well, as you said, a lot of people have a misconception about combat, but the guy gets off the plane under mortar attack, crawls to the airstrip, they throw him M16, he goes off in the jungle, and 12 months later, he crawls out of the jungle, throws his M16, gets on the plane, and leaves. Well, it's not quite like that. There's a lot of mundane times, but this particular incident you're talking about was we were on a patrol, our company was, and we had assigned with us some Kit Carson scouts, which were former VC who had entered the Chu Hoi program, in other words, gave up and decided to work with the South Vietnamese as scouts, and the program was called Kit Carson Scouts. I had three of those assigned to my platoon, and frankly, I was quite concerned about their loyalties, but besides that fact, they were ahead of me as we were going through the jungle, and as I had in Fort Benning in my training, we would walk through the woods, and we would reach over and pick up blackberries and just eat blackberries on the way. Nice little treat. Well, I noticed ahead of me the three Kit Carson scouts were picking these little red peppers, I guess, off the little trees as we walked through the jungle and just popping them in the mouth and eating them. And I thought, okay. So as I passed the bush, I reached down, picked up one, popped it in my mouth, actually bit the tip of it off, and it exploded in my mouth. I mean, I have never tasted anything as hot in my life. I sputtered, coughed, choked, turned red. It's like I'd been poisoned. I couldn't talk. So apparently they were very well accustomed to the hot peppers, and obviously I wasn't. It took me a little bit of time to recover. Everyone thought it was hilarious except for me.
Yes, indeed. There was another, you had a memorable, unexpected visitor one night on another situation there. Tell them about your guest.
You must be talking about the night visitor.
Yes, indeed.
During the last part of my tour, I was pulled out of the jungle at my reluctance and placed on a brigade staff at a brigade base camp, which was much different than living in a poncho hooch in the jungle for, 6.5 months. I came up to brigade base camp where we could have a hot shower, a hot meal a day, actually getting a haircut, clean clothes. Living wasn't bad at all. I had a GP Small 10th that I shared with another lieutenant. And my first night, Lieutenant Perkins told me, "So Frank, make sure when you go to bed tonight, tuck in your mosquito net real tight." Now, my sleeping accommodations were, I had a cot. On top of the cot was a blow-up sleeping mattress. On top of that was a sleeping bag. I mean, quite comfortable from what I'd been used to. And over my bed was a mosquito net that was tied to the top of the tent and hung down. And he said, "Make sure you tuck them under." And I said, "The mosquito's that bad here?" And he said, "Well, actually, we're on the side of the perimeter where the dump is located. And there's a lot of rodents around here, so just make sure you want to tuck it in." I said, "Oh, okay." Went to sleep. And sometime early in the morning, I felt a weight on the end of my feet at the bottom of my bunk. And I was half asleep and half awake. And I tried to move my feet. As I moved them, this weight shifted. So as I came out of my sleep and leaned up on my bed, I was peering straight into the eyes of the biggest damn rat I had ever seen in my life. It was ferocious looking. As you can imagine, I was up throwing mosquito net, sleeping bag, everything, helter-skelter. And it's good thing my .45 wasn't there, because I'm afraid I would have shot several holes in the tent, the same bags, and who knows, it scared the living daylights out of me. And I'd been frightened before, but this was a different kind of fear. Somewhere in the rat got away. That kept me awake for a good part of the night as I sat and shook and tried to calm back down. So you can imagine that the next night I made doggone sure that mosquito net was tucked securely underneath my sleeping bag so nothing could get in.
Yes, indeed. I'd like to talk about this one patrol you were on in which Private First Class Thomas Bennett was involved. Now, he didn't figure in, you never met him, but he appears right in the book, and it's a very moving passage, this section. And I'd like you to tell our listeners what all happened here, and what sets Bennett apart from everyone else that you fought with in Vietnam.
Well, Thomas Bennett was a remarkable young man. You're correct. I didn't meet him, but my medic assigned to my platoon, we always call our medics Doc, came into country with Private Bennett, and they were good friends. Well, they were assigned to different companies. Doc was assigned to me, and Bennett was assigned to Bravo Company, B Company. And a few months into my tour, Bravo Company walked into a huge North Vietnamese ambush, a U-shaped ambush, the typical, or not typical, but the ideal ambush on a large mountain called Chupa Mountain. We were sent in with another company to rescue Bravo Company from the ambush. So that they had been taking casualties for about 3 days by the time that we could get in to an LZ landing zone. When we got there, we were told there were heavy casualties. The enemy was withdrawing, although there were still snipers and machine gun fire in the area. There were heavy casualties, some dead, and some have actually been laying in the hot sun for a matter of days. So you can just imagine what that was like. In any event, my medic was tasked to go along with the team to recover the bodies and bring them back so that we could sling load them out to the mortuary. As it turned out, his friend, Thomas Bennett, had been killed while trying to tend to the wounded in that ambush. Thomas Bennett earned the Medal of Honor, by the way, a former West Virginian from the same state. He's highly revered in that state and has several monuments and things named after him. But in any event, my medic discovered his body, which mostly just tore him apart, as you might imagine. We recovered the bodies, brought them back to a hastily constructed pickup zone where we could get the bodies, get the wounded out first, and then the bodies. And my medic was totally... he was a basket case, to just put it that way. The most interesting thing about young Thomas Bennett was that he was a conscientious objector. He didn't believe in violence, but he believed he had a duty to his country, and he was the only conscientious objector to win the Medal of Honor, to my knowledge. And quite a remarkable young man, and an inspiration to all of us.
Yeah, in the Vietnam conflict.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
Yeah. When you were writing this, your memoir, what was the watershed moment for you?
I think probably, well, there were several, but probably the first that I remember was coming into this platoon of 30 men and finding all of a sudden I'm in charge. Everything that I've been taught now, you better work. I was pretty confident until I hit the ground and looked around and thought, okay, I hope I better do this because people were depending upon me. And I turned to my platoon sergeant, and he looked at me and said, "Sir, don't worry. You're going to be fine. We're going to get you through this." And in fact, he did. For the next few weeks, he took me under his wing, and from that point on, I became a combat veteran, and he left shortly after that. My next platoon sergeant was totally green, and all of a sudden, I was the old man, and he was looking to me for directions, and I was in charge. That was, and I realized that, yeah, I can do this. I'm a leader, and a lot of people were dependent upon me, and by golly, I'm going to get them home.
Okay.
I hate to interrupt, Dwight.
Yes,
we
sir.
We need to wrap this one up, please.
Okay. Frank, can you tell everyone where they can get your book?
Absolutely. It's available on my website, www.efranklinevans.com. You can also get it on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. It's available in Kindle, in ebook format. And that's probably the best way to get it is through Amazon.
Okay. Well, Frank, I'm so happy to have had you on our program. Thank you very much. I hope you have a great 2013.
Well, thank you, Dwight. Happy New Year to you, and I appreciate the opportunity for having me with you this morning.
Okay. So you're listening to At Ease at Veterans Radio Network. Take it away, Dale.
Okie dokie, and we'll be right back. We're going to take a look back at some of our older programs, and also we want to talk a little bit about Betty Flanders and Betty and her boys. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Thousands of American troops have come home from Iraq and Afghanistan with post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injuries.
I don't think anybody who goes into combat could ever honestly say that they're not different when they come home.
Don't brush us aside and don't count us out.
Help the USO support these troops and their families. Donate today at giveuso.org. The wounds are invisible. The stories are real.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and I just needed to play that little tune there because there's two women that I want to talk about just briefly, and Bob is joining me now on the air also.
Oh, yeah. By the way, Betty probably knew the chords to that one.
I'm sure that she did. This woman knew everything, I think.
She did. She was a walking jukebox.
let me talk, yeah, right, about Kay Wisely, first of all. And that is that Fran Wisely, excuse me, who organized the Pride and Honor flights here in Michigan, or in southeastern Michigan. And one of our partners, former partners, Ken Rogge, went on one of those flights to Washington with the World War II veterans. And I just wanted to say we're going to miss her and the activities that she was so involved in. And I think that it's just great. Bob, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I went too.
You went there?
Yes, sir. Wow, boy, when was that? I think about a year ago. Yep. And what an event. And so well organized. So well organized by the volunteers. Everything showed up on time. The food was there on time. Everything was moving quite along. Arlington was great. All the things that we saw in Washington. It was terrific.
Well, I reading her obituary, I saw that she had seen that this was going on, and she talked to her husband and said, "This is something we need to do." And so they did. And so, Faye, we're going to miss you, but thank you for what you did. The other woman that we talk about just briefly is, her name is Betty Flanders, and Betty is known throughout our area, especially because on Memorial Day she would always repeat the poem from World War I. at the local cemetery. She would go out to the senior citizens' home along with her band, Betty and the Boys.
And the Boys.
And you know, when I've heard that she passed away, I said, you know, we had her on the program, and we did. We had her on our very first year, and it's a little bit scary, but I was able to find the CD. So I'm going to ask you all to be a little bit patient here, and I'm going to play a little bit of Betty and the Boys and a little bit of her Smart Alecky. Oh, where did it go? I bet I lost it. Hold on, I'm going to cue this up. Bob, you can talk.
Yeah, well, I can say a few things. When I first met Betty, and I mean first time, and she was a delightful lady, about 5 foot nothing, and she had this real effervescent, eclectic, up attitude, because there I was, setting up the equipment, we were going to record her, and while she's playing, she looked over at me and she says, "Well there, who are you?" In a very flirtatious voice, which is another one of her signatures. She was able to charm the socks off of everyone, and deservedly so, because she was a charming person. It was absolutely all real. Her whole attitude was real. Her musical talent was real. Everything about her. And if you get a chance, folks, Betty, B-E-T-T-Y, Flanders, F-L-A-U-N-D-E-R-S. She died last week in Ann Arbor. Why don't you give that a Google and take a look at her a bit and read all the things that she did. And the woman, just to say that she was remarkable is a true understatement.
Just in one. There we go.
There we go.
Oh, there we are. Go ahead. Oh, cranked it up a little bit, man.
Some little problem. No. Anyway, this is Sherm Funk, and we're down at the Ypsilanti Independence Day Parade. This is the 75th annual Independence Day Parade right here in Ypsilanti. And we see the parade headed down right here towards us. This is we're starting out here. The Grand Marshal is going to be coming.
I'm
going to
skip ahead.
And,
this is back when we were covering a live parade in Ypsilanti.
We were covering great events, right?
Yes.
Right here
in front
like
of
the
us.
Dog show.
And moving kind of
anything to stay on the air, right?
Survive, anyway. Very nice so, day here.
We're going to skip ahead here, and I'll be right back. Anyway,
continuation.
I was working so hard to find this segment last night when she talks about with her friend
Michigan, Belleville,
Ralph Hardesty, who sang with Betty and the Boys. And unfortunately, both of them have passed away. Betty was 89 years old. She was a member of the USO back in the 40s. And she just continued on entertaining everybody.
May I say just something, who the Boys were. Now, these folks were all in their 80s, 70s and 80s, and they were not senile. They were not where you might say, oh, yeah, right, yeah. I mean, they were serious musicians, the Boys. She had to have the Boys. There was a drummer, that's all he did was drum. Even after the song was over, he kept going. So who else did they have, Dale? Did they have a trumpet or a sax, was it? Yeah, the piano player.
She played the electric organ.
Yeah,
and then there was a drummer. I believe there was a horn of some sort.
Yeah, one more. I'll say saxophone because that would be a trumpet would be too brassy for a small group. Well, what a name, Betty and the Boys. And as soon as they came on stage, everything got excited because she was excited. The music was excited. The woman traveled with the USO. Oh, did you find it?
I found something here.
Oh. Well.
That's like
yeah. That's a pretty one, isn't it?
That was wonderful. I have to ask you a question, and I know, Betty, you were married during World War II to Bill. Mm-hmm. And were you two married during the war?
No. I was a bit younger at that time, but we were married in 1948.
This is Ralph talking about her husband, who was in the studio with us.
Wow. Congratulations to you.
We were really lucky.
That is great. I just wanted to ask a question to Betty and Ralph, if you could answer it to. What was it like being home when the men were gone?
Well, it wasn't a fun time. And, you know, but I really, when I said goodbye to him, I was with him down in Fort Riley, Kansas for 2 years before he went overseas. But when he left that day, I said to myself, he'll be back. He'd better be.
All right, Betty, I'm sorry we have to cut you off there, but we've only got about 10 seconds to go. So I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio this year. Bob, thank you. Dwight, Nina, Maria, Gary, wherever you are, you're up there now with Betty. You got your own band, buddy.
Yeah.
We'll be talking to everybody. Thank you for listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be back next week with Bob and
Rebecca Grant.
Dr. Grant. Right. So until next time, you are dismissed.